bodiness. Breeze moving along the ridge. Maybe it could blow the many thoughts, stories, and feelings out through the hills, scattering them for miles and miles. Yet today, sitting on this sore bum, knees a little creaky, not sure why I would want to inhabit this fickle body. Difficulty pulling this buoyant mind down, down into this skittish body, staying only a moment, then off again. Prancing around, hoping to think myself out of all these discomforts, yet remembering the sacred and enchanted place, asking only to surrender to a body steeped in its own loveliness, body inhabiting body. Awareness grounded in this home, destined to feel itself one breath at a time. Making nothing out of all of this, resting in its totality, body in body. So, I start with story. You like story? Mm-hmm. Okay. Some of you, many of you heard this. This is an old story. I haven't told for maybe decades. I don't know. It used to be a kind of standard fare for body, but I really wanted to talk about body tonight. So I'm going to transport you back to the mid-60s. And I don't know if some of you, it's like, I was living in Paris, and I grew up mostly in Europe, and I met this guy from San Francisco, and he said, "Oh, you gotta go to, John, you're perfect, you gotta go to San Francisco," you know, and he was quite a character. He was a writer for Ramparts magazine, I don't know if you remember, years and years ago, quite a revolutionary character. But he inspired me that I had to make my way to San Francisco, not having been there, not knowing anybody. Just, you know, you just sometimes you just hear something and you just know you got to go. So, and I always joke because I think it was a Jefferson airplane or something, so, you know, Translove Airways. So that was really what I was on, was Translove Airways to San Francisco in 1966, you know, destined to, to disintegrate. But I want to tell party a little bit of the story about disintegration, because it really is about that so much of our cultural reference was based on disembodiment. So I arrived in San Francisco, and I don't know how long I was there, and they had one of these things where the human beings and Jefferson Airplane and Gary Snyder was there, and I don't know, the Grateful Dead. And, I was just kind of like, I was that wide-eyed young seeker, not knowing what I was looking for, of course, but it sounded like maybe there was a good idea there, which there was. And I remember Pigpen from the Grateful Dead handed me some pills, and I hey, why not? You know, I didn't come all this way for nothing, you know? So, you know, I took them. And I kind of stayed in there with all kinds of music and went on and on and on, you know. And it got close to dark, and, you know, everybody was leaving, and I was just kind of bug-eyed sitting there in the grass. And these people said, "Well, do you want to, where are you going?" I said, I'll go back to the Hate, you know. So they said, "Oh, we'll give you a ride." So I said, "Okay, great, give me a ride, yeah." So, you know, I kind of stumbled out, and they said, "Oh, I'm sorry, there's no room in the car." You can get in the trunk, though. So I did. You know, I got in the trunk, And they were all kind of, you know, what's it called, three sheets to wind or whatever, you know, or maybe four or five, I'm not sure. But it probably was the safest place was in the trunk. So they drove back, and it was just right off of Haight Street and stuff, and they all got out, and they forgot me, you know? And so I was there, and I went, oh, my God, what's happened, you know? And it was kind of getting late, you know, and so there was just nobody around, so, you know, what to do? So, and the thing was that, you know, interesting, I would kind of trip out, and I'd been on it for quite a few hours by then, and I would go out, and then I would come back. And when I came back, I realized, oh, my God. I'm in the trunk of a car, you know? And how am I going to get out of this thing? Well, actually, this going out and coming back went on all night, and sometime it was almost early morning somewhere in there. Some people walked by, and I banged on the thing, and this was an old car where you could push the button and the thing opened up. You know, I don't know if you remember these things, but you know, so they let me out. I kind of ventured off, but the thing that happened was that in that process, there was this whole level of dissociation, which actually I had been sort of in a lot of my life anyway. And so this was just a way of, you know, what is it like? Putting a frame around my world in some way. And it's interesting because for the next few months, this was, I think they dubbed this the Summer of Love. You heard about that. They also had the death of it, but that's okay. You know, but the thing was, I found that I slept in the park. I couldn't actually stay in a building. You know, there was a sense of claustrophobia, you know, that came with this. And so, but it was really an important experience for me because then I began this process of kind of, I'd started in Paris and I was on a quest, you know, and I'd gone to, you know, Zen Center, Suzuki Roshi, and I had, I hung out with the Hare Krishnas, you know. I mean, I kind of, you know, I was seeking, but I didn't realize that I possibly was looking in the wrong place, you know.
Who was the man with the hat?
Oh, the Karmapa. Yeah. That's a different story. We can only stay with this one story. Because I'm going to try to weave this into what I want to talk about tonight, which is essentially where, in so many ways, I see the kind of the Western paradigm here. That there was always this thing, I actually was fully immersed in the fact that I actually wanted to transcend my life. And there was something about the saints and about the fact that there was someone up there, out there, that would save me. You know, and I really, in some sense, I wanted to be saved. I thought, oh, you know, that if I could, you know, a little bit of 60s, if I could get high enough, I'd never come down. You know, I mean, that was kind of the part of the statements. So at this point, you know, I realized that I needed to somehow find my way. And I want to say, I ended up the next year or so in Berkeley, and there was a group there called the Tibetan Floating Lotus Magic Opera Company. And they did these full moon versions of theatrics of the life of the Buddha, you know.
Cool.
It was very cool, you know. And I made friends with him and kind of helped inspire me in some way. And the yoga teacher I had there, Surya, he had been in India. And I had two friends that said, you know, John, you don't belong here. You should just take off. And at that time, you know, India at that time was, it was a different India, you know. That's all I can say, you know. And being a seeker, one of the things was that I had to get to London. Then I hitchhiked across, I guess, to Italy, and then I took the TEE, the Trans-European Express, to Istanbul, and then made my way overland to India. You know. And this whole time, you know, I'd learned about fasting, and it was always about something about, can I get out of this? And really, in some ways, I dared not turn around and look at my past. And so there was a piece of, oh, well, maybe I could just transcend it. That's really what, you know, in the sense, I can say the psychedelics, the cultural, the time of the Vietnam War. And there was so much turmoil, you know, that there had to be some sense of, oh, somewhere out there, there is possibly some sanity. And so I made it to India. And the first year I lived in Nepal, and I had a Tibetan teacher. And, you know, it was interesting in those days. There was, out in Buddha now, it's like, oh my gosh, it just houses everything. It's a complex place now. But then it was simple. It was just rice fields. And where Lama Tupten Yeshe and Lama Tupten Zopa, this Russian princess Zina lived, was the old king's astrologer's house, and it overlooked Kathmandu Valley, and today is a big monastery, you know. But one of the things was I would sit up there with him, and there weren't, you know, I think there were like 8 students at the time, big, you know, and looking over the valley, you know, and we'd sit up there and we'd talk, and he was just. He was one of these people that, you know, you could feel his love, you know, and it wasn't for anything particular. It was just, you know, maybe just life and being, you know, and he loved the Dharma, you know. And one of the things he said, you know, John, you just don't get this. You don't understand it, you know. And I said, well, why? I said, you know, I just wanted to go, you know, it's like, I remember I took him to the movies at the United States Information Service in Kathmandu when the landing on the moon. And he said, oh, no, no big deal, you know. he turned to me, he said, you know, you've got it wrong. You think you can get out of this. He said, but the Dharma is you have to, and it's one of those things, you know, one of those moments where what we work for, he pointed and said, you have to go through this, you know, pointing at my body. And I really didn't know what he meant, you know. And it actually took me quite a few years to understand that what was the basis of the Buddha's awakening, you know. From Buddha. With this fathom-long body is found all the teachings, is found suffering, the cause of suffering, and the end of suffering. You know. And so really this process of going through, unfortunately, and it took me some years of doing retreats, I met this teacher S.N. Goenka and traveled with him for years, you know. And one of the things was that, you know, the first retreat I went to, the first retreat was 6 weeks. But The first was just, I sat down and, the first 10 days, what I did was I didn't do the instructions, but what I did do is I was trying to make a chronological understanding of my life. So I went back over and over trying to line everything up, of where I'd been, what had happened, and I'd been a lot by then. And when I started doing that, I did it over and over again. And then I began to cry and realized, oh, I had just been running. I was a good runner. And I had not turned around and allowed myself to feel the suffering that I had gone through. So there was a whole process there of like, oh, I have to, I can't disembody, I have to go through. And it's not to get caught up in it. It's simply that sometimes, particularly good runners, which I was really good, that suddenly you're kind of slammed up against something and you then turn around. And then you have to own your past. It's interesting because, in essence, one of the kind of Western paradigm here, and particularly, growing up in Europe and in Switzerland in a little village, and then there was this, like, it was this Catholicism. You went in and there was like so much smoke you could barely see, everything was in Latin, you didn't understand anything, and it was, but there was a sense of transcendence. That somehow, there was something beyond. And somehow, that Western paradigm, that the fact that there was a possibility that you could transcend the body and find higher. Calling higher realm, higher being. So it was built in, the idea of transcendence, as a cultural piece, And really what the Buddha was trying to teach was not transcendence, but something completely different. It's called transformation. And transformation was really the heart of how this worked. That somehow, that if you were able to kind of own what it was that was the past, the present, and not anticipating the future, and knowing somehow that this had everything in it. You didn't need to, merge with something else, that you could actually find it in this body, in this place. This is from Hakuin Zenji, the Song of Zazen. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. How sad people ignore the near and search for truth afar, like someone in the midst of water, crying out for thirst. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here before your eyes. This very place is the pure lotus land, this very body, the Buddha. So there is a piece of, turning around, and there's a piece of ownership. But with that paradigm, and I don't think this is solely the Western paradigm, is that energetically, all tendencies are, in essence, to go up. So in a sense, we're quite adept at being able to live in our heads and somehow believe that it's enough. And what the Buddha was pointing at was actually, it's not about, in a sense, the transcendence or, the life of the mind in that way, but it's about wholeness. And wholeness is essential for this kind of, they use the word Buddha nature, to be, in a sense, it's not something, it's something to be realized. So it's not even an experience, it's something that we slowly begin to inhabit. And this is reversing the order where, everything, you become afraid, you go up. You get anxious, you go up. You want to control things, you go up. So everything's in this elevator going up. And here is this language of, oh, no, you gotta push the button and go down. That's really what happens. And it's why, for me, a lot of it, I spend a lot of years in this sweeping technique, but this is this capacity to come down, and I think for many Western folk, is the belly. Oh, can I hang out there? Even though it does not have the same ability to collect or concentrate, But what does it have? It has a simple thing called ground. And one of the things is to bring it down, is that when there's a sense of ground, there's this sense of safety. And one of the primary functions is when we become afraid, we go up. When we get anxious, we go. If we bring the attention down and actually begin to make that contact, one of the things is the first one is safety. And you, in essence, you know what it's like not to feel safe. And here is something that is, by the way, it is a training. It's a mind training that you have to inhabit over and over. And unfortunately, because we put so much energy and kind of the natural consequence of kind of going up and trying to transcend in some fashion, then this is a bit of work, And there's a lot, because it's really based on, well, here's a pattern, and I want to, in a sense, kind of reverse my original, training or habit. When you're a little kid, I think you're kind of already connected on some level. There is that thing of a child has that as a natural truth. But what also happens is we're really simple creatures. I just want to be loved. And I have the capacity to love others. So that's pretty simple, isn't it? But then you think of a child who begins to, see their, in sometimes more complex family systems, whether it's brothers, sisters, or, and they're dependent, their needs are dependent on the parents. And so what does the child want to do? It wants to please the parents so it can be loved, right? And that's kind of the natural thing. But to do that, somehow to please the parent or parents, one has to begin a process. And the process is called comparison. And as soon as we begin, if we start this comparison too early, then it becomes part of the dissociative reality. And it just came from, you know, just wanting to be loved, you know? And yet, then suddenly the whole ideal was, no, I have to perform, you know? And if I perform well, then I will be loved. So this begins a whole unpacking, you know, that goes on sometimes a little bit forever. But the sad truth is that that comparing mind especially becomes very critical and judgmental, that it undermines it. You know? So it actually doesn't get the love it originally wanted. You know? What did it create? It created separateness. You know? And that separateness was defended. Sometimes at all costs, believing somehow it still goes back to that same thing. Oh, then, you know, then I'll be loved. It'll be okay, you know? Well, did it work out? You know? I don't think so, you know. I think on some level, and this is where we are now, is we have to turn around. And we turn around, and first we have to, in a sense, you have to own your past. You know, you're not your product. You're not separate from it. And at the same time, you have kind of created these habits due to a lot of it. Sometimes I think it's just due to wanting control of the situation, which also happens in the head. And then we have to suddenly realize this isn't going to do it this time. So you're all here, you got it. I'm not worried about you, you know? And because you got it, then you have to retrain yourself. And you have to train yourself to kind of bring yourself down and stay connected. You know? And it's a thing I will be saying over and over and over, you know, is you can use the breath. Again, these practices can be used for transcendence. But ultimately, what we're trying to do here, even though that's true, and I certainly know that world, really this whole thing around access concentration is that actually we're using that collected, that mind that's, in a sense, it's not off chasing mental images or giants. It's actually turning its attention to feel. No. Feel. Why? Because feelings are actually, you know, if there is a dominance here, sometimes we think it's our head that's running the show. But the truth is, it's not our heads that are running the show. What is, you know, it certainly puts up the options. You know, it calculates options. But when it comes down to the kind of, what is it, the wire or what? No, that's probably the wrong word. But, you know, when it comes down to push comes to shove or whatever, that actually it's the feelings. It's like, oh, that's what. And the feelings are, when I'm aware of my body, I got a couple moments of space between the thought and the reaction. And that is incredibly powerful. And it may sound very simplistic, but those moments, you know, where there's a little space, there's incredible amount of wisdom can be ignited. And, you know, sometimes it's restraint and sometimes it's action. But that little space is invariably probably the most important. You think you can think it, but actually It's you're going to make that decision. You know, I could say, you know, kind of the intuitive, the heart part will make the decision. The calculation will certainly give options. But when it comes right down to the wire, you know, I guess that is the right word, then we kind of know what it is. So this is, you know, sometimes they're incredible people that you would think were completely transcendent. And one of them was a forest monk back in the days when the 100 years ago when the teak forests of northern Thailand and were, you know, it was a canopy with kind of elephants and tigers and big mama snakes and all that stuff, you know. And there were you know, in the Indian tradition there were sadhus who inhabited the forests and lived in the caves and weren't around people so much. And Ajahn Mun Mahabharata was the teacher of the Venerable Ajahn Chah. And again, I spoke of it that they only met for a short time. But his world was that of the forest, you know. And many Thai masters were directly through his, you know, sometimes very short periods change their lives, you know. So I'd like to, this is kind of a classic piece, you know. In your investigation of the world, never, and this is someone who truly is transformed and also, you know, was considered an arhat in the tradition. Never allow the mind to desert the body. Examine its nature. See the elements that comprise it. See the impermanence, the suffering, the selflessness of the body while sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. When its true nature is seen fully and lucidly by the heart, the wonders of the world will become clear. In this way, the purity of the mind can shine forth, timeless and delivered. When its true nature is seen fully and lucidly by the heart, the wonders of the world will become clear. In this way, the purity of mind can shine forth, timeless and delivered. So again, it's just this, you know, this really understanding of the Buddha Dharma as a process that transforms one. And in a sense, that transformation is a good heart, clear mind, and a whole body. You know who Alice Miller, the psychologist, was many moons ago? I'm kind of passé in most things. The truth about our childhood is stored up in our body. And although we can repress it, we can never alter it. Our intellect can be deceived, our feelings manipulated, and concepts confused, and our body tricked, this is Alice, with meditation. But someday our body will present its bill, for it's an incorruptible as a child, who, still whole in spirit, will accept no compromise or excuses. It will not stop. It will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. I thought that's straightforward. You know, one of the things was this retreat was to be held in Ursula Hall, and you know, and with Steve Armstrong. So the venue completely changed. You know, it burned down, and he got sick. Wow. That's what is, you know. So this is one of the older Nursuland nuns. I remember, you know, I first went there, there were a bunch still alive. They've all passed away. I went there before they turned it into a retreat center there. And there were still some of them alive there. It smelled, whoa. You know, it's kind of like a urine smell, you know. It was pretty bad, you know. But, you know, these were the kind of the last of their breed coming out of kind of Italy. And and now, you know, they don't wear habits and they, you know, are more social workers and teachers. But then these were cloistered nuns. That means, you know, they didn't talk at all. They went and they prayed together. That was about it, and they did their chores. I was taught to be ashamed of my female body from the start. In years of the training in the church, I was forced to ignore every aspect of my body. Instead, they held up to me all these saints who sacrificed their sinful bodies and died as martyrs. It was an uptight spirituality which deeply reinforced my own inner shame. Wow. No. So we have a lot to work with here. You know? And as at the beginning of this talk, I said, the Buddha said, oh, you know, for you to inhabit this thing and attend to it and begin to line up, it's really the lining up of the mind, the body, and the heart, because that's really what has to happen here. That's how it works, you know. And then there is this intelligence, you know, and heart. For things, but it's a lot of work to stay. You know. Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't need to do all this, but anyway, Kabir. I like Kabir. Okay. I laugh when I hear that the fish in the water is thirsty. You don't grasp the fact that which is most of life is inside your own house. And so you walk from one holy city to the next with a confused look. Kabir will tell you the truth. Go wherever you like, to Calcutta or Tibet. If you cannot find where your soul is hidden, for you the world will never be real. Good stuff, huh? So I think that's, you know, I just really wanted to emphasize that, first of all, you've been walking around in it the whole time. And you have, you know, you outthink it, dissociate, and that here is this training, which is, you know, I like, you know, for me, I've come to a point in my life where I actually most of the time I'm in my body. I'm kind of, you know, it took a long time. It's only 50 some years, but the thing is, and don't take that. The thing is that it's just a little bit of space between everything, you know, because then the mind can't just jump. It has to actually connect, and then it can jump. By the way. You know, so there is this capacity or possibility, you know. Of this lining up and that there is, first of all, there is, you know, it's not like we are going to add anything to it. We're simply going to recognize that there is a natural wakefulness that exists that's not, in a sense, separate from. It has to all be kind of one integrated thing. And then that recognition that there is this, you know, as Ajahn Chah calls it, there with the knowing, this simple awareness, you know, that is unfettered. It is truly unfettered. And it becomes, in its, from the wholeness itself, we begin to see that, what is your project here? Oh, it's to relax. Because then one neither needs a future, nor no longer needs to work a past. No. So suddenly there is everything available here. No? So you always already had it. But unfortunately, you know, through the comparing mind, you, in a sense, dissociated. And now you come to these practices and we reassociate with it. And with that, one of the lovely things is the Buddha said, well, you know, in the body is also suffering, the cause of suffering, and freedom from suffering. And that's the big freedom from suffering. No. Good enough? It's what I wish for you. But I know it takes a bit of, you know, remembering over and over. So let's just sit for a moment.